This is an audio archive edition of WINA's Charlottesville Right Now with Coy Barefoot, brought to you by the Charlottesville Podcasting Network at sevillepodcast.com.
Let's welcome to the studio Patrick Griffin. He's a history of he's a professor of history at the University of Virginia, and his new book is American Leviathan: Empire, Nation, and Revolutionary Frontier. Thank you so much for coming in. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me, Coy.
Let's talk first about the title, American Leviathan. I actually had to go on Wikipedia and remind myself, Leviathan, I think that was Hobbes. And what exactly was that? Why the title?
Well, you're exactly right. It is Hobbes. I mean, historians notoriously like to find new theory, wrap up old ideas in new theory. And I'm a little bit different that way. I have an old kind of idea. What is the American Revolution? But I wrapped it in a very old theory. Thomas Hobbes was a 17th century English theorist, and he wrote a famous tract called Leviathan. And in this tract, he basically said that when people are alone in a state of nature, life is not inconvenient. Life is not like Shangri-La. Life is nasty, brutish, and short. And people will fight each other, and it becomes this world of all against all, as he put it. And ultimately, it takes a Leviathan. And Leviathan is a term that means great whale or great beast of the sea. But it takes a Leviathan, or a state, in order to bring that very disorderly world back into order. And so I decided to, when I looked at the West, I said, well, let me, how does it work? And what I found is that Thomas Hobbes, to a certain extent, was right, is that in this particular context, at this particular period of time, the only thing that could bring order to disorder in America was a Leviathan, the American state, hence the title, American Leviathan.
And of course, Hobbes was contrasted with Rousseau, who thought that the state of nature, everything was hunky-dory and everybody was fine.
Yeah, or then even more so with John Locke. And I think Locke is the guy that we always look to when we think about, like, who is the one who inspired the American Revolution. And Locke wrote the state of nature was one that was just inconvenient, and that the state arose to deal with kind of the normal jostling between people, between all these free agents with inalienable rights. Hobbes is writing during a very different context. He was writing during the English Civil War, was really bloody, really nasty, period of upheaval. And so when I looked at the American West, what I saw was a period that was almost very akin to that moment in time. And so I started to look across time and say, what do all of these moments of civil war or revolution or unrest have in common? And it has to do with people fighting with one another, literally fighting, over issues of sovereignty to decide who's going to rule the state and then ultimately what the nature of that new state is going to be.
My next question was, what's the thesis of the book? But I think you've already covered that. Anything else about people might, when they go buy the book, which I recommend that they do, and they pick this up and they spend some time with it, what did we learn?
Well, let me tell you a bit of a story in order to get into that. And it's a story I start the book out with. It's a story of this fellow by the name of Tom Quick. It's really a legend more than anything else, but it goes something like this. There was this guy by the name of Tom Quick, and he grew up on a Pennsylvania frontier. And this is just before the French and Indian War. He happened to be good friends with many of the Indians in the area. He ran around with them as a kid. He learned a lot of their ways, et cetera, et cetera. Typical almost American tale. At one time during the Seven Years' War, he's crossing a frozen river in Pennsylvania with his father. And he notices that there's a raiding party of Indians coming after them. His father starts to fall through the ice. Tom Quick runs to the shore. His father ultimately is killed and scalped, and an Indian steals his silver cufflinks and silver buckles. At that point, Tom decided he was going to become a great Indian avenger. And he declared from that moment on he was going to kill 100 Indians before he died. And he killed every Indian he came across. He stabbed them. He threw them off of cliffs. He shot them, bludgeoned them. He even killed children, declaring at one point that nits make lice, so we have to wipe them all out. Ultimately, as legend has it anyway, he died after he had killed 99. And as he was laying on his deathbed, asking his relatives to bring one more Indian in front of his rifle, he passed away, ironically, of smallpox, of course, the great killer of Native Americans.
Right, right.
Well, the legend goes on after that an Indian, a starving Indian, came by and dug up his grave and ate his diseased liver, and that Indian died then of smallpox. So Quick actually got his man. Now, why do I write about it? Do I want to valorize these guys? Absolutely not. What I'm saying is that if we want to understand to a certain extent what the revolution is about, we have to start looking at people like this. And we have to start looking in the violent world in which they lived, as opposed to kind of the nice, neat worlds that we're looking at this revolution, that we normally think about the revolution in.
My guest is Professor of History Patrick Griffin from the University of Virginia. His new book is American Leviathan, Empire, Nation, and Revolutionary Frontier. If you've got a comment or a question about the American Revolution, the phone number is 977-1070. Do you think we as Americans dramatically underestimate the violence and the bloodshed of the Revolutionary War, of this period in history, because we all sort of learned about it as kids, and so it was sort of cleaned up and packaged very nicely for grade schoolers?
Oh, absolutely. It's a very sanitized revolution, isn't it? Just think of the popular images we have. When you think like of British redcoats, you can almost see the whites of their stockings or something like that as they come marching along. And that isn't the revolution at all. We tend to think of the revolution as being people like Thomas Jefferson, Ben Franklin, George Washington, the founders, and we focus upon them and their ideas. What we don't focus often upon is the bloodshed, and this was a very bloody war. It was more in line with some of the other revolutions that we don't think America had anything in common with. The French Revolution, the Russian Revolution, we think those are real revolutions. But the American Revolution is often seen as this more polite war of independence. And I think the reason you say that, you know, the reason you give is right on the mark. It's as school children, we learn that famous litany of things that happened in Boston, things that happened in Philadelphia, and it's all about acts. It's all about parliament. It's about rights. It's about kind of ideals of resistance and everything like that.
And it's almost all preordained.
Absolutely.
And determined at the outset.
Yeah. It's almost like a bit of a morality play, right? We know the beginning, we know the middle, and of course that we know the end, that by the time you have the Constitution, it's all over. Wipe our hands. We've had this nice, clean revolution. Isn't that just lovely? And that's kind of the story of the revolution that we have. And we've all been brought up with that.
And your book really explores sort of the story behind the story. What really happened behind the scenes, out in the streets, out in the woods, out on the frontier with Americans that we've never heard of. They don't have monuments to them. They weren't the founders. They were just average Americans in incredibly extraordinary, very frightening circumstances.
Yeah, they were. What I do is I take it to the most extreme region. I take you to the frontier where it literally was a world of kind of fight of all against all. But to a certain extent, the same types of pressures were gripping all of these communities. And what you find is that people were living in constrained circumstances, people living with difficult choices, people living amidst fear and disorder and violence. And these were the kind of three defining ideas that kind of shaped their worlds on a daily basis. And they had to figure out ways of overcoming these. In the West, tragically enough, that answer came to be Indian hating. Indian hating came to be the way that people brought some kind of mental order to this world of disorder all around them. It's a way that they learned how to deal with fear and deal with violence.
And it also, did it sort of bring the whites together, the settlers together with a common enemy?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Before then, there were all kinds of divisions in the West, but there were all kinds of divisions in every society at all times, right? Class divisions, ethnic divisions, religious divisions. The West was the same way, especially class divisions between wealthy speculators and poor squatters. That was one of the defining characteristics. But one thing over the course of the war that brought them together, of course, was the hatred of Indians. That was kind of the lowest common denominator that bound all these people together. And after a while, they say, this is the thing that we really believe has to organize our society. And then they started to demand that the state was going to act on their behalf based upon this idea that the state was going to have to step in to eradicate or at least remove Native Americans, that through this war, whites learned that they could not live with Indians.
My guest is Patrick Griffin. He's a professor of history at the University of Virginia, and his new book is American Leviathan, Empire, Nation, and Revolutionary Frontier. And of course, the state did step in a big way and responded to that call to go after the Native Americans.
They did, but reluctantly. What you have is kind of a reluctant state in many ways at first. Easterners wanted no part of this, and they were hoping that the thing would just go away on its own. They were hoping that they could ignore it. Now, they sent out a few armies in the early 1790s that effectively did nothing. It's just the opposite happened. Indians routed one of them when they were sent out. But then ultimately, Westerners push and push and push some more. And what I say in my book is you want to understand the final push for this was actually the Whiskey Rebellion. We think it's just a bunch of drunken louts out there just drinking as much as they possibly can, or just kind of saying that this excise tax on whiskey is something that discriminates against us. And of course, this is one of the defining characteristics, or one of the defining events of the early republic. And I say, no. This is really the last chapter of the American Revolution. What's really happening here is these Westerners now are arguing that if you don't come and help us, to the state and to Easterners in general, we're going to set up an alternative society here on our own. That in effect, that the secession of the South from the North was not a worry at this time, but the secession of the West from the East was a very real worry. And it's at that moment when the state actually steps in and acts, when the state decisively comes in And of course, famously, George Washington is going to send two armies in 1794, one's to put down the Whiskey Rebels, and the other is going to be sent out to put down Native Americans. He gets this guy out of the, an old general out of the Revolution, Mad Anthony Wayne. And Anthony Wayne goes out and actually destroys an Indian army.
And people may not realize how many towns across the Midwest are actually named for Wayne.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, even
Fort Wayne, for example.
Fort Wayne, Indiana. My wife's family is from Waynesville, North Carolina, also named for, out in the mountains, named for him. Now, that's, Patrick, that's really fascinating that at this time, see, most Americans don't realize this, that that we just think we just marched out across the West and pushed Native Americans out of the way. We don't realize that the West was actually on the verge of being its own nation.
Oh, absolutely. It really was. And again, this was just a chaotic world, and this was a way for people trying to bring some order to all of this chaos. Ultimately, the state's going to act, and then the state is going to become really the force behind expansion in many ways. As Americans, we don't really think about this often, and we think that we have this kind of weak, ineffectual state that really wasn't doing anything from the get-go. We still have that myth with us today, but not at all. What you had here was a state that was really kind of in cahoots in many ways with some of these people to push west and push Indians out west.
Patrick Griffin is a professor of history from the University of Virginia. The book is American Leviathan. We're talking about that. If you've got a question, 977-1070. You talk in your book about the crisis of sovereignty. Is this what we're talking about here out in the West, where nobody was really in charge? And we sort of think about the Wild West a generation or a few generations, 100 years later,
right,
as that period. But what you're saying is, hey, out in the Ohio River Valley in Ohio, was even worse.
Oh, it was much worse, where you had really no sovereign power at all for a while could claim ownership of this territory. Many of them tried. Many of them tried to say that we are sovereign. The British first come in after 1763, after the Seven Years' War, and impose their own sort of sovereignty. And ultimately, that fails. And I cover the reasons why in the book and how the people out there who were living had a problem with British notions of sovereignty. But sovereignty, and this is, again, going back to Thomas Hobbes, he thought this was the kind of the lifeblood of a commonwealth, is that you take it away, everything falls apart. Again, there are some of us, and we'd like to believe, and certainly I would like to believe, that kind of if, you know, that if you live in this wonderful kind of stateless society, that everything's going to work out. But, you know, we often find that when you really examine things, it doesn't work out that well. And so sovereignty is critically important. And sovereignty is what's at stake at this particular period of time. We'd almost think, too, that American sovereignty was foreordained. It wasn't foreordained in the West. Virginians, for example, Virginians clamored for a long time to kind of make the West theirs. And they were the first to really act in this period of disorder to try to bring sovereignty to the broad West.
So what you learned in all these years of research for this book, have you vindicated Hobbes? I mean, can we look back and say, you know, Hobbes had it right all along?
Yeah, I think that, you know, I hate to say this because, of course, we right away we think of Hobbes and we think of like a fascist or something like that. But maybe because I'm getting older or something like that. But really, the more I read, the more I think that he had something, I mean, in certain contexts anyway, that he certainly, I think is right. And it's not to say, you know, that people here were reading Hobbes. Most of them would have never, probably none of them would have ever heard of Thomas Hobbes or anything like that. But I'm just saying that in certain contexts, kind of the observations that he came up with, the way societies function, way societies fall apart, way societies are reconstituted, he was on the mark. Alas, that is the case.
Patrick Griffin's new book is American Leviathan, Empire, Nation, and Revolutionary Frontier. Empire, that's one of the subwords there in your subtitle. Tell us about America as an empire and what we should understand today.
Yeah, I think this is another kind of, it's a mythic conception of what America is, and it's an understandable one. But we don't like to think of ourselves as imperial in any way, shape, or form. I mean, today I think we're finally grappling with the idea of what an imperial America might look like, what it might mean, and what the implications of it are. But as I write in the book, I think America was born as an empire the moment it was born as a nation. The two went hand in hand. As a matter of fact, the negotiations that went in to ensure that the nation would be stable, that it wouldn't be dealing with unrest generation after generation after generation, was the creation of an empire in the West, that America from that point forward was going to necessarily be expansionist. And I think this is a key point. Hey, we're living in Charlottesville, right, the home of Thomas Jefferson, and Jefferson famously said that we are now living in an empire of liberty. And we often think that people like Jefferson were the ones who were behind this kind of push West. What I want to say is that, of course, people like that had something to do with it, but it's really these common people. folks in a way like you and me, who are the ones who are behind behind this imperial thrust of the alienation.
Because Jefferson didn't put all his belongings in a wagon and head west like the average Americans did and get out in the middle of nowhere with very little maps and try to figure out how they were going to live and raise their family.
Yeah, exactly. And I'm not, you know, it's very easy, I think, to, you know, you raise an interesting point. It's very easy to look at these people and to demonize them as Indian killers. And I think you, in certain cases, you really should. I mean, like the Tom Quick myth, there's other appalling instances of massacres perpetrated by these sorts of folks and everything like that. But on the other hand, as I said before, they're in constrained circumstances. These are people who are trying to keep body and soul together, who are worried about what the next day is going to bring and are living in very, very difficult conditions. And these are the people who are going to be, in a certain extent, the stormtroopers of American civilization. That's the way they see themselves, and that's in a way the effect what they will be.
There's a line in your book that jumped out at me here. This paradox holds us together. As Americans, we are held together by a paradox. What did you mean?
Well, I think paradox in many kinds of ways. I think the paradox of myth and reality. We have these mythic notions of what America is. And I try to deal with some of those ideas of what myth is and how this early myth comes about. So I think that our past is very different from the way that we would like to perceive ourselves. That's one paradox. Another paradox that I deal with is kind of the paradox of the founders. I think that we think of the revolution, as you said before, kind of as a way school children do, right? That still is the predominant way. And we think this is the founders' revolution. And on the other hand, we have to venerate the founders, but in actual fact, it was really common folk who were behind things that were going on. That's another paradox as well. So I end with a lot of these. And finally, of course, there's one other, the great one. It's, of course, Americans did create the notion of popular sovereignty. Right? The bedrock of democracy, if you will, at the time of the American Revolution. And they institutionalized it. We the people, the Constitution. On the other hand, this went hand in hand with things like Indian killing. That's something else that's very difficult for us, I think, as Americans to come to terms with, to recognize. But that is part of our past.
You end your book with a discussion. The epilogue looks at the George Rogers Clark Monument right here in Charlottesville. Right. It even includes a photograph of the monument, an old photograph, right out near the UVA corner, near the UVA hospital.
That's right.
What is significant about that statue, and what does it tell you?
Well, the first time, and maybe, you know, my wife hears these things, so she's bored by them all the time, but I was walking down the street with her, and we're looking at it, and I start to just kind of riff on what this thing is, saying, oh my gosh, look at this, it epitomizes everything about my book, and I start talking. She says, well, why don't you write about it? And she's right, as she usually is. And so what I did was I decided to make it the epilogue, and I started doing a little bit of research into the monument. The monument is a fascinating, well, it's not, I mean, you look at it, it's nothing great. And certainly the backdrop is as ugly could be. But to me, it's a story of America, and it's a story that Americans need to believe. What you have are groupings of three. You have in the center, of course, George Rogers Clark, looking young, trim, and handsome, astride his horse, and he seems to be beckoning the way forward. And in front of him, you find these noble savages. You find some Indians who are standing there, some who are just obviously standing in the way of inexorable progress. And then behind them are the most interesting ones, as far as I was concerned. There were these people who were of almost indeterminate race. They were kind of Indians that were wearing what you would consider to be the clothing of white men. On the other hand, they appeared to be kind of what were called at the time white savages, white men who appeared to be like Indians. And I said that really kind of sums up what I think is at work here, is that this is the myth that we have to believe, the myth that George Rogers Clark, founders, elites like him, were the ones who were paving the way for all sorts of success. And I'm saying, don't look so much at Clark. Look at the men behind Clark. The men behind Clark are really what's kind of at work here in the American Revolution. They were the ones who were kind of pressing the way further west. And as I said, and this gets back to the question about paradox, I think that we look at guys like Clark and we kind of say, oh, aren't they wonderful? The founders. That's the way most people deal with it. Just look at Barnes and Noble. I mean, these bookshelves there are groaning with books about the founders, right?
Right. Yeah.
On the other hand, academics are always kind of trying to kind of knock them down, kind of say, oh, they have clay feet or something like that. And I say, wait, you know, we missed the boat by that. I think the debate itself about the founders tells us a great deal about who we are. And I think that this statue is a perfect example of that. We have to believe that Clark was behind it.
Patrick Griffin is a professor of history at the University of Virginia, and his new book is American Leviathan, Empire, Nation, and Revolutionary Frontier. Thank you so much. I've enjoyed it.
Oh, I thank you.
You've been listening to WINA's Charlottesville Right Now with Coy Barefoot. Charlottesville Right Now is broadcast live Monday through Friday on News Radio 1070 WINA from 4 to 6 p.m. Best-selling author and historian Coy Barefoot is the host and producer. To participate in the program, you can call 434-977-1070. Coy can be reached at barefoot@wina.com. This is the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, SevillePodcast.com.